Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show here with Brian Diaz. Happy to be here with you on a Thursday afternoon, the unofficial start to the weekend here in the Crescent City, friends. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate it. If you're listening on a Thursday, happy Thursday. If you're listening to the podcast, thanks for tuning in to the podcast or downloading it or streaming it or whatever, however that works. Somebody was actually asking me that today, friends, about the podcast. A friend of mine who comes in from out of town here and there, lives in LA, and he said, I've been trying to get the podcast, and I think I did something wrong. And I said to him, I said, well, it's on iTunes, and it's on Google Play and TuneIn Radio and all that good stuff, and you can get it on noladrinks.com. We always post it on Fridays at about midday is when it finds its way to the interwebs. But he said, well, so what did I do wrong? And I said, I really don't know. I said, I just kind of like upload the podcast to the thing and it just kind of happens. It's just kind of out there. So I guess I have to kind of look into that a little bit. I'm not sure how my buddy there, Jim, went wrong, but hopefully we'll get him straightened out. And if you already know how to do the podcast, I'm glad you do. Somebody does, I think. So that's out there. That's pretty cool. Friends, a couple things going on today, or at least one thing that I want to mention. Jazz concerts, as always, here in the spring going on at Armstrong Park every Thursday, late afternoon through the evening. Starts at 4 o'clock. I think the music starts at about 5 or 5:30, which is perfect because this show doesn't end until 5, so you can't go until then, okay? But at 4 o'clock, they have food trucks out there. They have artisans out there, people doing different things, selling beers, all that good stuff. And today, being that it is April 13th, this is a good one. And actually, it's Preservation Hall All-Stars. How can you go wrong with the Preservation Hall All-Stars? Man, and I always like when they say Preservation Hall All-Stars, because if you're pretty much playing in Preservation Hall, you're an all-star. So, you know, there you go. And then also the Latin band Otra, who does Latin jazz stuff, and they're excellent as well. So they'll probably start at about 5, and then Preservation Hall kicks off probably, I'm going to guess, you know, 6:30, something like that. It's a free concert, Armstrong Park, really cool spot right over there, of course, on Rampart Street, if you're not from the area and you don't know that. They do this every fall, they do this every spring, and the spring series is going to run through June 1st. So definitely well worth catching if you can. Also wanted to mention over there at the Ogden Museum, like I want to touch on every once in a great while. If you are a Louisiana resident, the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, which is a very fine museum, they are at 925 Camp Street. All you have to do is show a Louisiana ID, friends, and you get in for free. They're open from 10 to 5 during the days on Thursdays. So, you know, knock off work for a couple hours and go check it out. Great art collection, Southern art collection, and a wonderful group there. The Hellas Foundation is the one who makes this possible. So just show up with a proper Louisiana ID over at the Ogden, again, 925 Camp Street, every Thursday between 10 and 5. Again, can't go today because you got to wait till the show's over. But next week you can go, and it's free to get in. So pretty cool. Also going on this evening, over at Pearl Wine Company at the American Can Building, a little bit of an interesting wine tasting. So they do free wine tastings every Thursday from 5 to 7 p.m., and they do them every Friday at the same time. Now, the nice thing about Thursday is you also have the Crescent City Farmers Market going on. That's in the whole, the building there is at 3700 Orleans Avenue there in Mid-City, and it's one of the three or four Crescent City Farmers Markets that goes on throughout the week in town. So you can go support local farmers and local producers of wonderful foodstuffs there. Always a good thing to do, support local. Check that out, and you can go do a little bit of shopping, and then from 5 to 7, you can go in, and you can check out the wine tasting. Now, I mentioned it, a bit of an interesting wine tasting. They are featuring wines from the state of Virginia. And you might go, now maybe you know this, but Virginia's been at the wine game for really, well, I mean, actually, technically, historically, for a very long time, like centuries. You know, Thomas Jefferson actually grew grapes and so on and so forth. But the wine industry in modern times has started to really come into its own maybe in the past 10 or so years. Like many wine regions, friends, Virginia, and we're talking about, you know, contemporary times, they kind of started out maybe trying to grow things that really wouldn't work particularly well. Sort of a common refrain, right? People think that they're going to just grow Cabernet and Chardonnay wherever they are, and it doesn't quite work, and it takes a wine region some years to shake down, figure it out, figure out what it is that you do well, figure out what it is you can actually grow in a particular spot. And I think in, you know, I'll go back maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years, Virginia's really started to figure it out, what they do well there. So, for example, you know, some nice Pinot Grigio, some really good Cabernet Franc comes out of there, some nice sparklings. So they're going to be featuring wines of Virginia, there at Pearl Wine Company, 5 to 7 p.m., free wine tasting. Go check it out. So if you're kind of curious, I think Virginia is the fifth largest wine producing state, something along those lines in the country, and it continues to grow. There's a whole bunch of wineries there you can go check out. But this is a good way to dip your toe in the water if you're interested and curious about wines from the state of Virginia. So go check it out. 5 to 7 p.m. Pearl Wine Company, American Can Building. All right. Also coming up over the weekend, this is going to be a lot of fun. Our good friends there at Pontchartrain Vineyards have the second concert that they have going on for the Jazz and the Vine Spring 2017 concert series. And in this particular iteration coming up here is the North Shore's own Amanda Shaw and the Cute Guys. Always a very popular show. Amanda Shaw, obviously the fantastic Cajun fiddler. You know, she broke onto the scene probably about 15 years ago as a so-called child prodigy and became exceptionally popular. A little known fact about Amanda Shaw is that she was actually up for the role of Hannah Montana, but Miley Cyrus got it instead. Think about those two different career trajectories, friends. But there you go. Amanda Shaw puts on a great show. And that concert is out there at Pontchartrain Vineyards this Saturday, 6:30 to 9 p.m. You can buy tickets online up until 3 o'clock on Saturday, the day of the show. $10 a person. Or you can buy them at the gate beginning at 5 o'clock, also $10 a person. But if you want to get a really sweet deal, if you want to get a really special deal, this is an online-only deal. So, again, it ends at 3 o'clock the day of the show. You can get two tickets and a bottle of their 2013 Voodoo Zinfandel for $25, friends. So that's a pretty good deal there. Again, online only up until 3 o'clock. Shows from 6:30 to 9, gates open at 5 o'clock. If you're looking for more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com. It is an outdoor concert festival, so you can bring chairs and blankets and small tables or TV trays, that sort of thing. Might want to think about bringing a little bit of bug spray this time of year, maybe. Maybe even a little bit of sunscreen, because the sun, still... starting to stay out a little bit later. Go check it out. Just go check out PontchartrainVineyards.com for more information there. That's going to be a lot of fun. Coming up on the show next week, our good friends from the U.S. Bartenders Guild New Orleans chapter is putting on a regional meeting, which they do. They're part of the Southern region, go figure. And it moves around throughout the Southern region every year, and they do about four or five, I think it's cut up four or five different ways throughout the country for the overall U.S. Bartenders Guild, and they are hosting the regional, Southern Regional, the week after next. And it's a professional development thing. There's lots of seminars, some understanding of brands. We talk about this all the time on the show that bartenders are professionals. This is a professional development conference. And it's very interesting, a lot of the things that go on, because our particular chapter of the U.S. Bartenders Guild here in New Orleans is especially socially minded. One of the important things that's going to be going on is a seminar on how to prevent and circumvent and avoid sexual assault in bars. And it's a really well done program put on by Mark Shetler and Molly Bird, friends of the show, and they're going to be putting on that seminar and all kinds of other really good things. We're going to have Mark on and probably a couple other folks from the chapter next week talking a little bit about the event and just letting you know what our Bartenders Guild chapter is up to here in New Orleans. So it should be interesting. So tune in next week. Coming up today on the show, friends, we're going to talk a little bit about French Quarter Festival, which just wrapped up, of course, over the weekend here. A lot of fun, a lot of sun, a lot of people. A whole lot of people, a lot of empty chairs. We're going to talk a little bit about that after the break. And then coming in, we'll talk a little bit about the beer industry. And then coming in the second hour, I have three friends coming in. Ashton Berry from the Ace Hotel, Steve Yamada from 12 Mile Limit, who's also putting on an interesting event this weekend as well, and Johnny Sanders from Bar Tonique. Now, Johnny will be here hopefully on time, but it is entirely dependent on whether his refrigerator repairman takes care of business in a timely fashion. So that's what we have going on in the second hour, friends. Hope you stay tuned to the Noel Drink Show. We're going to take a little break here, and we're going to be right back. We're going to talk about our French Quarter Festival wrap-up. Come on back.
Goodbye, Joe. I got to go. Me old Mayo.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass wine you drink.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks again for tuning in. As we mentioned before, and as you probably know, if you're here from the New Orleans area or familiar with what goes on, we just finished up with French Quarter Festival this past weekend, and what a great event that is, friends. It's one of my favorite things to do every year, always knock off for those, what is now a four-day free music festival that takes place throughout the French Quarter and a couple places just outside the French Quarter. And, you know, it's actually become the world's largest, the United States, this country's largest free music festival. And it shows. And hey, look, it's a great event. Don't get me wrong. I absolutely love it. But man, there's a lot of people out there. Actually, last year was a record setting year. If you listen to the show last week, we talked about it a little bit. Last year was 760,000 roughly people attended the event, and the numbers just came out this morning, I believe. This is reported by Offbeat in an article by Sam DiArcangelo and a companion piece that I'll get to in a minute that he wrote the other day. But this year was about 700,000, so down about 60,000 people, which when you figure how beautiful the weather was out there the past weekend, I don't think you could ask for better weather to line up with the festival. It never seems to really happen that way. It's hard to imagine that the record wasn't broken yet again, but it could be perhaps an effect of so many people being there and the festival perhaps in some ways bursting at the seams. It is now a full day on Thursday. Essentially, not all the stages are open, but there's a good half dozen or five or so that go on Thursday, a few more on Friday, and then all 24 stages, I believe it's 24, are in service, if you will, on Saturday and Sunday. And boy, Friday was such a day that it almost reminded me of Saturday a few years ago, even a couple years ago. So the festival continues to grow. And this is, you know, well, again, down 60,000 people, but huge. They did set records, apparently, for food and beverage vending, as well as merchandise sales at this one. And that's good. It's a free festival. That's what supports the festival. So, you know, when you get out there and you buy some food from some of the local restaurants and drinks and these sorts of things in the venues there, the various venues and around those stages, it does support the festival. And so that's really good news. The festival, of course, was, if you listen to the show last week, we talked about this, but the festival, of course, was originally, this was the 34th anniversary, I believe, of it, and it was started in the early 80s as a way to actually bring locals back to the French Quarter. There had been, during that time in 84, I guess it was, there had been, did I get that right? 84? Something like that. There were a lot of street construction was going on, and this was during the mayorship of Ernest Dutch Morial there. And the idea of the festival was, again, to get people back into the French Quarter. It was very much a locals festival. In the first year, it was attended by maybe a few hundred people, and it was a very small-scale event. It has now grown into an event that brings in out-of-towners, people from last year. They reported at least a dozen countries. I think it was more than that, probably. And this year, I'm sure, no exception. So it's really no longer a locals event. It is an international event that draws music lovers from all over the world. So, you know, as these things do, these good events, they grow and they grow. And that's really all very good news. But it's transformed what this festival has become. And I think it does raise some interesting questions about it. The crowds in certain locations, say up on the river, which is a closed area, meaning they have a security check and you can't bring in outside food and beverage. Jackson Square being another one of those, up by the old U.S. Mint by Esplanade there, same kind of thing. It is so crowded and so hard to get around that it can be sort of maybe a little bit unpleasant. And so what a lot of people do, and this was the companion piece by Offbeat there that I was just mentioning about how the chair problem has gotten a little bit out of control, and I would tend to agree. What people do is then, because of these crowds and these other considerations, is people bring their folding chairs, their festival chairs out, and they set them up along the river and things like that in Waldenburg Park or in Jackson Square, and people are trying to get spots in the shade, people are trying to get spots right up by the stage, these sorts of things. And the congestion of the chairs by, say, the Abita Beer Stage, one of the two stages in Waldenburg Park along the river, was it was almost impossible to navigate. And people tend to be a little bit self-serving, I will say it that way. They come and set up their chairs, they plop them right down in front of the stage. Now imagine, friends, you might have 20,000 people trying to watch, say, the example given in the article was Aaron Neville making his French Quarter Festival debut Thursday afternoon, and people have their chairs that are not even being sat in right up against the stage. This is generally where people stand. So if you consider an event, say like Jazz Fest, or even what I believe they do at Blues and Barbecue at Lafayette Square, the same with Wednesdays at the Square at Lafayette Square, that music festival going on right now, as you know, they have signs that say no chairs beyond this point, meaning so the stuff up close to the stage is a standing room only kind of thing, and then you can set up your chairs in back. Now that seems to make some amount of sense to me. I think the problem when you deal with French Quarter Festival is being able to enforce some sort of consideration like that. That's pretty tough to be able to do. It is a free festival, friends. These things cost money. As an aside, people that I talk to occasionally will say, with all these crowds, why don't they add more stages? Well, the problem is that stages cost money, right? They cost the sound guy, the stage manager, the sound equipment, the, you know, the stage itself, the infrastructure there. They're paying the bands. Actually, the bands do get paid. I think in a lot of cases, not a whole lot of money, but they do get paid. Excuse me, they do get paid. So it's not just as simple as adding more stages. You know, basically that increased the cost in an already free festival. So that maybe really doesn't work. But that was my little side note there, being realistic. And how can we deal with it? Sort of the chair problem is almost a vehicle to me of some other considerations going on. Do we start to charge? Not we, you know, I'm not involved, but does the French Quarter Festival, French Quarter Festival Incorporated, do they start to charge for the event? Do they maybe charge to get in to the closed areas, again, like Jackson Square or Waldenburg Park along the river or the Mint? That's really difficult to say. It kind of taints the flavor, perhaps, of what is, again, the country's largest free music festival. No simple answer there. But something I think I agree with Sam D'Arcangelo, the writer there for Offbeat that I mentioned, something probably does need to be done with the chair component here. People just, again, they just plop their chairs down. They cut in front of other people who have been there longer, plop their chairs down, squeeze them in, and oftentimes leave for part of the day and then come back and expect their chairs to be there and just plop right down. Now, a lot of people do sit there all day and they patronize the places and these sorts of things. But Sam suggests here in his piece that, you know, again, the no chairs beyond this point sign, as I mentioned, I think that's a great idea. The problem is enforcement. Are you going to be able to have enough security to enforce that? I think you also need to consider some other stuff like, you know, keeping avenues clear, or aisles, if you will, clear so people can come and go to go support the vendors or go use the restroom or go take a walk, whatever they do. He also suggests potentially charging a chair fee. So maybe a daily kind of, and again, this would be in these closed areas, not really everywhere. It's not as much of a problem, say, on the Royal Street or Bourbon Street, the open stages. But, you know, you pay a fee. Maybe it's a daily fee or for the whole festival, a modest fee, maybe $10, $20. Get a sticker on your chair or something. And that would, you know, probably encourage people to bring their chairs less or end up with less chairs is probably a better way to say it. Then he jokingly goes on to say the chairs left unoccupied for more than 5 minutes should be thrown into the Mississippi River. And then he backs. So he's, of course, joking about that, saying that, of course, the river's polluted enough. We don't need that. And then really kind of closes off the piece. Let's just engage in some common courtesy, friends. And I think that that's really the big thing. Now, I realize when you have nearly 750,000 people in what is a pretty small area watching a music festival, expecting people to engage in common courtesy universally is probably too high of an expectation of humanity. But I think they're sort of part of it. And maybe, you know, some steps can be taken to encourage people through announcements, when they give the little handout schedule. Maybe there that is already in there. I don't know. But, you know, talking about how to engage in common courtesy. And just as an aside, again, one of the things that my wife, Sylvia, and I always do is we help our good friend, Lindsay Zayorski, who is a wonderful jazz singer here in town, traditional jazz singer. We help her sell CDs at her performance, and she usually plays in the afternoon. In this case, she did on Sunday at noon on the Royal Street stage. She used to be on one of the Royal Street stages in the street there. She used to be always at the French Market stage on the traditional jazz stage, and I think this was a better move. Different story for another day, but we were helping her sell CDs, and one of the things that we do whenever we do that is that we actually you know, we set up right by the stage. And in this case, we didn't have a table. We used a music stand and we folded that over to kind of make a little tabletop out of it to put the CDs on. And, you know, we were there next to the stage trying to sell CDs. Well, then what ends up happening is about a half a dozen people come and they sit down right in front of the music stand and people want to walk up and buy CDs. Well, then that kind of closed off sales there briefly for a little while because people didn't want to squeeze up. So we had to ask them to move. And again, just a little common courtesy. You see us selling CDs there. If you could just create a walkway of just a few feet to allow people to step up and buy CDs, that would be great. In fact, one guy who sat down put his feet right under the music stand, and that's where my wife and I had put our Pimm's cups that we were drinking. So I had to ask the guy to move his feet because he was either going to kick my Pimm's cup over or I was going to get a toe in my drink one way or the other, something along those lines. Anyway, again, French Quarter Festival, friends, it's a really great event. It'll be back around next April, of course, as always. I'm not trying to knock it. I'm just saying there's some things that need to be dealt with the number of people. Common courtesy, friends. There you go, a little bit of thought on the festival. Friends, come on back to the Noel Drink Show. We got more for you. Come on back.
The French Market is a place where history is made fresh daily. From the historic Upper Pontalba building on Jackson Square to the ever-evolving Farmers Market, our six-block district celebrates New Orleans food, music, and culture through events, festivals, walking tours, health and fitness classes, and also children's workshops at the New Orleans Jazz Park. Visit our calendar of events at www.frenchmarket.org. The French Market, making history fun since 1791.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In 2008, the Louisiana legislature made the Sazerac cocktail the official cocktail of New Orleans, affirming what New Orleanians had known for over 150 years. You just can't beat a good Sazerac. The Sazerac cocktail is the quintessential New Orleans drink, perfect for celebrating the arrival of fall festivals, football season, or just being proud to be a New Orleanian. For the official recipe, visit www.sazerac.com.
This is Christopher Icaza, General Manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucouleurs. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's Grand Dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon Dining Room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint. And it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers!
Back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. If you're listening on a Thursday, happy Thursday, everybody. If you're listening in here on WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans, I appreciate if you're listening to the podcast. Happy whatever day it is for you when you happen to be listening. Either way, I appreciate you listening here to the NOLA Drink Show, as always. Folks, an interesting piece came out in the New York Times the other day by Jim Cook, who is the founder and owner there of Sam Adams Brewery in Boston, the famous start out as a regional brewery. And the title of the piece that he wrote is called, Is It Last Call for Craft Beer? And there's some interesting trends going on. Of course, here in New Orleans, we know, and Southeast Louisiana, really the whole country, but in this part of our part of the world, there's been a significant uptick in the number of small craft production beers locally. And that's a great thing. A lot of really cool, innovative stuff serving our market in this part of the world. And that's kind of the tradition of breweries and small breweries in this country and frankly, really anywhere. But what Jim's talking about here in this piece, well, let me unpack some of this. So he was talking about in 1981, there were only 82 breweries in the entire country. And now there are over 5,300 breweries. The vast majority of those are, as he puts it, small, innovative craft breweries making unique, flavorful, creative brews. And the industry has basically, the craft beer industry specifically, has been enjoying about a 15% growth per year, and double digit growth is fantastic. And now it's down to single digits. And something else, as he says, is, you know, any mature industry, that's to be expected. That double digit growth is just not going to last. But it's not just the mature industry or segment of the industry that we're talking about, or at least that's what he argues. And I do agree with him on all of this, is that it's because of the basically the lack of government antitrust oversight and the dramatic consolidation of beer production, beer producers in this country and globally in the past few years. He mentions in 2008 when the Department of Justice here approved the creation of a duopoly in the beer industry that allowed Molson Coors and SAB Miller to merge. So that was the creation of Miller Coors, of course. And then 5 months later, they allowed the merger of Anheuser-Busch and InBev, which is a huge company owned by Brazilian people now, I believe, is the owner. But anyway, that created two massive beer conglomerates, and that accounted for about 90% of all domestic beer production. Now, in some other parts of the world, the entities, especially the Anheuser-Busch InBev merger, they were required to divest certain parts of things and stuff like that. I don't want to get too far into that today. But again, about 90% of domestic beer production was in the hands of these two conglomerates. And, you know, as he argues, the immediate result was a 6% increase in beer prices, and that ended the decades-long decline in real beer prices. Drinkers here in this country began paying nearly $2 million a year more for their beer. He goes on to say that 5,000 Americans lost their jobs due to the cost cutting and the merger and all that sort of stuff. And it saved the owners of these two groups an estimated $2 billion. He also mentions that these two groups are able to successfully or have been able to successfully reduce their tax bills, and a lot of their profits, because of where these companies are now based and operate, have moved their profits offshore. Now, the next thing that he goes on to talk about, which is also, I think, a significant issue, is that we've had a consolidation, not just on the brewery level there, but on the wholesalers or distributors. Now, here in Louisiana, we are a mandatory three-tiered state. The so-called second tier is our wholesalers and distributors, and that is also dominated by a small handful of big guys. And in most cases here, we're talking about Republic National Distribution Corporation, and then the recently merged Glazer and Southern, which is now Southern Glazer, and they have a huge share of the market, and I'll get into that in a second. But in 1980, as the article says, there were 4,600 wholesalers in the country, and you know, most markets had small competing wholesalers, and you could choose, say, in a place like California where you could self-distribute, you could choose to use a distributor or you didn't have to. Okay, in Louisiana, you have to. But you're in Northern California, you're a winemaker, a small beer guy, didn't have the manpower to go staff sales down in Southern California, so you hired a wholesaler down in the Southern California market area to work for you. But now it's gone from 4,600 in 1980 to 3,000. Now, a lot of these are smaller guys, but we are talking about a very top-heavy number, 3-4 major distributors. And the result, of course, too, that, and this is where we kind of get this double hit here, is that these distributors, especially the big guys, favor their primary suppliers over independent craft guys. A lot of this is because there's the name recognition out there. These things sometimes tend to be cheaper. The primary suppliers have a lot of muscle as far as their ability to promote their own brand. So the distributors sort of essentially get free advertising, if you want to look at it this way, all that kind of stuff. Oftentimes the salespeople are getting spiff from the larger producers that the small guys can't really provide or compete with. You know, free trips to Napa are pretty appealing, friends, if you're selling wine, and if you're a small winery, you can't really offer that. So, you know, we've basically had the consolidation of beer producers, and this really goes for wine. You know, a lot of the wine portfolios are being consolidated, and this also goes for spirits. Just as an aside, we've talked about the New Orleans Bourbon Festival that went on 2-3 weeks ago. It was very interesting to see. I had no idea that what a huge chunk of the bourbon industry in Kentucky is actually owned by 2 or 3 companies. They own basically everything. There's a handful, it's something like 24 maybe, small craft distillers, and some of them, 2, 3, 4 of them, were actually at the event. But again, hard for small companies to travel to an event like this. The big guys, Diageo and some of these folks that have the ability to travel and put up booths and participate, that's where you're getting a lot of that visibility. Now, it goes on to say that, you know, this article goes on to talk about how the effect of all of this, and really does, it can take jobs away from local brands and these sorts of things. You know, it hurts the small craft producer. And then the good ones, or many of them, I shouldn't say good or bad, many of them actually get just snapped up. So one of the things that he goes on to mention is, you know, why is this really important to us? Who cares? And he mentions the fine brewery Goose Island, that they make a beer that everybody's still buying, but that's owned by AB InBev, Anheuser-Busch InBev. And, you know, that's kind of a problem. problem. A lot of these people are being bought up. I also find it somewhat ironic that many ad campaigns in recent years by the big guys are actually make fun of craft beers and craft brands, beer brands. And, you know, a lot of them, their portfolio, they're buying them up at the same time. So people probably don't realize that a lot of what they think are independently owned craft breweries are not actually independently owned. They're owned by the big guys. And it makes it really hard for these folks to compete. And again, lots of times, as we know, the local breweries here and our local distilleries and other things, they employ local workers. They pay local taxes. It's an American manufacturing sector, frankly, that with a lot of these big guys is being outsourced. It's being sent offshore, if you will, or we have foreign controlling interest in some of this stuff, and that's not where the money's going. So I do agree that there are some potential threats there. Some could also argue that another threat is the oversaturation of craft breweries in the marketplace in certain areas. You know, again, there's a lot popping up here in New Orleans, just as an example. I don't necessarily know if I agree with that or not. But, you know, it is another factor potentially squeezing the craft beer market. But there is a threat from this, friends, that if we're talking about, this sort of duopoly, which I think is an accurate term, with these two large beer producers, and then the extra effect of consolidation in the distributor, the second tier. And again, I think we see it greatly in New Orleans and in this area where, and many areas, for example, that a lot of these folks are more concerned with how wide their case displays are on the grocery store floors than they are worrying about the particular brands that they sell, some of the smaller brands, the quality, these things. And look, I'm not saying these people are all bad. I'm not saying all distributors are bad. I certainly think that there are some that are much better than others. There are a lot of small distributors out there that do a really good job, hand sell the product, have small mom and pop stuff in their portfolio, and that's great. But the consolidation of these larger distributors and in how they dominate the marketplace force the little guy out, don't necessarily emphasize craft production in wine, in spirits, in beer, is a threat. And again, you know, the large production consolidation that we're talking about by the big guys in also in wine and spirits and beer is also a threat. So something to consider, you know, look into if you're into craft beer and you want to support local and you want to support these small mom and pop guys of any type of beverage that you like, do a little bit of research. See if they're still, most of them started out as independents, but a lot of them, again, have been snapped up by the big guys. So, you know, take a look at who's out there and do a little bit of research. And, you know, in the case of here in New Orleans, the half a dozen, seven or eight or so that we have in the Southeast Louisiana area, as far as I know, they're all still independently owned. So support local, buy local. There you go. Support our local breweries. Friends, thanks for tuning in here to the Noel Drink Show. We'll be back with more. Come on back.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm going to need to parachute when I get through walking these blues. When I get back to New Orleans, got my suitcase in my hand. Now ain't that a shame? I'm leaving here today. Yes, I'm going back home to stay. Yes, I'm walking to New Orleans.
You used to... Hey, ladies. Are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello Wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello Wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region. Producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood. Or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak. To our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
Such a night. You're such a night. Sweet confusion under the moonlight. Such a night.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans. Yeah, a little bit of Dr. John, and I was telling BJ, who's working the board, as he always does, doing a fine job. How you doing over there, BJ? You got your microphone there, buddy?
I'm doing very well.
All right, yeah, doing good. So I asked BJ to cue up a little Dr. John because I was driving across the bridge, live over on the North Shore, coming into the studio today, and I was listening to WWOZ, which I usually do listening to music, and they played four Dr. John songs in a row. But I tuned in the middle, and I thought, oh no, okay. After like three Dr. John songs in a row, and then the fourth Dr. John song, I went, oh no, the dude died. No, don't tell me he died. And then the DJ just came back on and said, hey, I just wanted to hear some deep Dr. John cuts. I'm like, all's right in the world. We're all good. So we just played a little Dr. John.
Well, hopefully he prefaced that before he played four songs in a row.
Maybe he did. I tuned in like right in the middle of the first song.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hey, Dr. John. And then another song, I'm like, okay, Dr. John Rock Block. Third song, uh-oh.
Right.
Fourth song, oh no.
We can't lose him and Chuck Berry.
No, that would just be terrible. So all was well in the world. Dr. John was actually just fine, I think. If he's listening, I'm sure he's not. I hope you're doing good there, Mac.
Yeah.
Anyway, friends, I wanted to mention we had a caller call in during the break, and they were wanting to know if we were going to have somebody on talking about whiskey. No, not necessarily, but I am always happy to talk about whiskey, so I'll talk a little bit about whiskey. I was going to actually talk about this next week in a little bit more detail, but we talked about the New Orleans Bourbon Festival that went on a couple weeks ago, really cool event that we attended, went to the tasting, some of these things, and some really interesting stuff out there. One of the things that I wanted to mention, there's a really cool book out there. It's by a guy, his name is Michael Veach, V-E-A-C-H, and the book is called Kentucky Bourbon Whiskey and American Heritage. And I picked up a copy of the book. I haven't had a chance to read it and get through much of it yet, but I went to Michael's presentation talking about the New Orleans connection to bourbon. Now, of course, not going to get into too much detail about it. You can really make bourbon, and people think that bourbon has to come from Kentucky. That is not the case. It has to come from the United States. It has to be 51% of a mash bill has to be corn. Okay, some other considerations, some things like that. But we'll talk more in more detail about that down the road. But Michael's theory is the name bourbon and the long-held idea of the name bourbon. People in Kentucky, they purport this story, is that it actually comes from Bourbon County in Kentucky. And he actually refutes this, and some of it is because of the timing of when bourbon was called bourbon and first called bourbon in Kentucky. Really, the name is not embraced until the 1870s. Some of the earliest mentions of it are in the 1820s. And one of the bits of evidence that was out there was you would have sort of a bill of lading on the containers that the bourbon were in, and it said something like limestone. Kentucky Bourbon County, something like that. And his point was that when this was actually going on, with some of these original ones were dug up, I believe in the early 19th century, the town of Limestone was actually only in, if I understand this correctly, only in Bourbon County for 2 years. And this was actually during a time, and the stuff was being shipped down the river to New Orleans, this was actually during a time when the Spanish still controlled New Orleans and trade was effectively blocked with the United States. So making a very long story short there, his argument was, if you were actually, you know, you said, hey, there was probably some amount of black market stuff going on, but if you're engaging in black market trade, would you staple an invoice with the name of the provenance of where something came from to your vessel, to your barrel, to whatever? He would argue no. Now, interestingly enough, the other thing that he talks about is that the key market for bourbon and bourbon production, when bourbon was Kentucky whiskey was originally made, it was a clear distilled spirit. it was not selling well in New Orleans. And there is some evidence of this. And again, we'll talk about this more down the road. I'd like to have Michael on the show when he comes down and do some more research here in New Orleans. But that it was not particularly popular here. And he makes the argument why, because this is a, you know, was a place, it was a French territory, and obviously the strong French tradition, which is very familiar with the concept of cognac. And of course, cognac, another grape distillate, just like Armagnac, these sorts of things, but aged in barrels. So his theory is such that, and he has some good evidence for this. I'm sort of glossing over the story here a little bit. You can check it out in the book, Kentucky Bourbon Whiskey, American Heritage. But he makes the argument that they really wanted to be in this market. And obviously when stuff is coming down from Kentucky, they would put the stuff on the flatboats. They would come down the Ohio River and then merge with the Mississippi. And then basically these flatboats would be abandoned here. And a lot of actually some of the original buildings in the French Quarter before the two significant fires back then were made from the wood from the flatboats of Kentucky wood, believe it or not. But the, you know, it was a clear distillate and just was not particularly popular here. He has a theory then that there were, and there's again some more evidence to back this up, I'm not just making this up and he's not pulling it out of his backside, is that there were two brothers, he's kind of boiled this down, he's trying to find some proof of this, but two brothers that were actually French guys that owned a grocery, and back then a grocery, the concept was a little bit more, you're like a wholesaler or a trader, not just like going to Rouse's, okay? And they opened up in the, I believe it was 1821, opened up a mercantile type exchange in Lexington in Kentucky, or Louisville, one of the two, Louisville, I guess. And they had some connection, not them specifically as cognac producers, but they had some connection through family or something to cognac production in France. So he theorized that there was some perhaps influence from these guys or others that people wanted to see bourbon aged, or whiskey, excuse me, again, whiskey, aged in barrels to be more palatable to the New Orleans market. And again, he's got a lot of compelling evidence due to timing and some of these other things. So his theory is actually the name bourbon does not come from Bourbon County, Kentucky, again, because we really don't see that till much later, but that it actually comes from Bourbon Street. And of course, Bourbon Street is one of the original streets in New Orleans. And so his theory is somewhat that, say, people traveling on riverboats, these sorts of things, saying, give me that whiskey that I had on Bourbon Street, because it started to become very popular here once it was aged in barrels. So he kind of backs the story up pretty well. Now, it is probably somewhat heretical to say this in Kentucky. If you're talking to bourbon manufacturers and these sorts of things, they don't like that story. But it is a very compelling story, again, because of the timing of what he talks about. And there are some instances, the earliest mention of bourbon is in, I think, 1820, 1821 in Kentucky. And it was a piece of writing from a particular grocer up in Kentucky telling a distiller, reordering some barrels and saying, hey, you know, I like what you do. He's talking about the clear whiskey distillate, saying, but I've heard from down the river that if you age the whiskey in barrels, it becomes more palatable or tastes better or something. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm still ordering it. Just an idea. So somehow, some way, the idea of aging bourbon in barrels doesn't seem like it came from Kentucky. So the Elijah Craig story about how the distillery accidentally caught on fire in what was something like 1770 doesn't really work particularly well, because how would you burn barrels accidentally and not have the barrels totally burn up on both sides and have an unusable barrel? It wouldn't just burn on the insides, right, where you get the toasting going on. And there was also another story about aging that Elijah Craig puts forward a few years later about aging salted fish. And Michael Veach makes the argument that if you age salted fish in any barrel, it is going to taste like salted fish, whatever liquid you put in it thereafter. So kind of compelling stuff. Check it out, Kentucky Bourbon Whiskey and American Heritage by Michael Veach. And again, this was sort of on the fly here. We'll talk a little bit more about it, and I'll get my facts a little straighter, but that is the general concept, friends. Come on back to hour number two of the NOLA Drink Show. We're going to have some guests in the studio. We're going to talk about stuff. That's what we do. Come on back.
to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
With the season's beautiful weather, it's a perfect time to take a drive across Lake Pontchartrain and visit New Orleans' only local vineyard and winery, Pontchartrain Vineyards. Our tasting room is open Wednesday through Sunday from noon till 4, or by appointment. Come enjoy a flight of our wines in our classically styled French Provençal tasting room, or pack a picnic lunch and enjoy a bottle of wine on our patio overlooking the vineyard. While you're there, ask about our wine club. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to Over Oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc. A great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in to hour number two of the show. Happy to have you here. And hey, we're doing a radio show. That's what we do. If you're listening to the podcast, I appreciate you doing that too. However you are listening to the NOLA Drinks Show, I greatly appreciate it. So here, hour number two, we have some guests that are here, and our last and final guest just rolled in. Here she is, Ashton Berry. Hi, Ashton.
Hello, how's everybody doing?
Good, good. I figured since you were last, I was going to throw you right on the spot first. We're also joined by Steve Yamada. So Ashton Berry with the lobby bar there at the Ace Hotel here, just down the street, up the street from us on Carondelet. And we also have Steve Yamada here, who is, Steve, you're still at 12-mile limit, aren't you?
Still plugging away at 12-mile limit. Haven't changed jobs yet.
Okay, good. You know, I was actually, the reason why I asked you this question is when I called you today and I got your outgoing voicemail,
oh, God.
It still said something about Ace Hotel or Seaworthy or something.
Maybe
along
I'm
those
just
lines.
Hoping they'll take me back one of these
was,
days.
Was that what it is? I want. I wanted to make sure that I didn't get that wrong or something, that you repatriated yourself. You were reaccommodated back into the Ace Hotel. And also joined by my good friend Johnny Sanders, who is with Bar Tonique. Johnny, how are you?
Hello, how's it going?
Good, man. It's great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
As always. And Johnny, I'm going to start with you, and we're going to kind of go in a very different direction than what we sometimes do. No, that's not true. We just kind of go in whatever direction on the show. We all know that. I did not know that you have a sort of a nom de turntable. I'm going to use that term, Johnny Five, as a DJ. And you are one bad DJ, dude. I never heard you DJ before until the They Blinded Me with Signs fundraiser a couple weeks ago. And you just killed it, man.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. Sam asked me to do that.
Get right up on
it. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
There you go.
Sam asked me to do that pretty early on, and then last minute almost didn't happen. But, you know, it's fun to do that, do a little fundraiser, especially for the coastal restoration.
Yeah.
First, yeah, totally.
That was a great, that was a really cool event. We did a show, as you guys probably know, we did a show on that a few weeks back prior to the event. And we actually had Natasha Nordoff, who is Gulf Coast Restoration Network, is actually right upstairs from us.
Oh, really?
So it was an easy commute for her to get here to the station. And she came in, we talked about the program, we talked about the fundraiser and all that. And it was a really neat event. I look forward to y'all doing it again next year. Steve, you were there as a part of it as well.
Yeah, I was serving lemon drops, which it was pretty funny because they asked for recipe submissions. And nobody came out and said, like, what is your cocktail? This looks dumb. And because I mean, like, really, it was just like, but I think everybody was thinking it because, like, you know, once I showed up and showed them what I was doing a live experiment at the thing where we were testing the difference between shaken and stirred cocktails, basically. And we were doing a blind science test with that. So once I explained that to Sam and Katie and Noel, they're like, oh, we got it. We thought you were just being lazy. And it's like, no, guys, I wasn't. I promise.
There was some solid science behind that. And then we had to vote on, well, yeah, I'm quote, solid science.
It right. It was drunken science.
Some serious science.
Yeah, serious science. And it was pretty cool because what you ask people to do is you ask people to pick their favorite, you know, could you tell the difference between the two?
Mm-hmm.
And it was the, you were talking about oxygenation and the dead zone, the oxygen anaerobic zone mm-hmm. in the Gulf. And then you're asking people to tell the difference between the drink and then vote. I actually never heard the results.
Oh, it was pretty funny because I think a lot of people just, it was one of those things where it really need to be a very blind experiment. Like we should have blindfolds or something like that. But so it kind of skewed the results where people were like, oh, I'm looking for the shaking cocktail because I know that's going to be the right one. But I was really interested throughout the evening. We would have people come up and it's like, oh, I know this one's the shaken one, so I'm definitely going to vote for it. And there were multiple occasions where it wasn't. It was a stirred cocktail. Just like, no, you're wrong. I mean, I don't mean to say you're wrong. I mean, this is just like what you think it tastes better.
Right.
But maybe you like a more acidic, less mellow, like, you know, drink, which like a stirred cocktail
like a stirred.
Would be.
I'm curious, which one was it?
Cocktail A was shaken. Yeah. Cocktail B was brought down to temperature in a metal pitcher and lightly stirred to like reduce oxidization.
Really interesting because a lot of people I saw say A is definitely stirred.
Yeah.
I was like, it's not.
And actually, I was going to come to you next because I know. I was just going to get because you were not actually doing like a booth or a drink. You were there like me, just drinking.
Yeah.
And so, what was your take on Steve's drink?
I liked it because I really tried to, since I have a psalm background, I really tried to like do the whole blind thing and really like not try to like think too much about the visual look of it. I mean, honestly, at that point, by the time I got there, they had been sitting out long enough that I was kind of like, if you're assuming that one is shaken or one is stirred by the visual appearance, like, I don't know.
Right.
We've been here for a little minute at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I do like stirred drinks. Mm-hmm. I also know that my palate leans really, really towards high acidity.
Okay.
So it doesn't surprise me that he said B was stirred because B was the one that I liked.
That, okay.
It was a little slightly unbalanced. It was definitely more citrus, like the citrus yep. popped in a way that yep. wasn't like always, you know.
Yep.
And it doesn't surprise me, but it was funny that so many people were like, B shaken, A stirred. You know, so many people like rely on like really like what they think their visual and they, in cocktails specifically, mm-hmm. I think sometimes we rely more on the visual than we do on our actual palettes.
Right.
We like yes. don't take out the visual. And visual is a ton of part of like drinking and everything like that. But like sometimes you have to take that out because mm-hmm. it can totally skew your view of a drink.
Yes. With that as well, absolutely. Too, like just those norms that people think with cocktails, like yes. every time you put citrus in a cocktail, like juice in a cocktail, you have to shake it. It's like, that's not true. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like you could stir a drink that's a sour and it can turn out really well if it's a specific cocktail, you know, if it's balanced yeah. a specific way, if that's the flavor profile you're going to. So just those norms where it has to be like this formula, you always shake citrus juice, you always stir straight spirits. It's like there's exceptions either way.
These things are guidelines and general frameworks for things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting to taste those side by side. And as you said, Ashton, that you know, they'd been there for a little while. The drinks have been out for a little while. I found that choice A was a little, the shaken one, it tasted a little stronger to me.
Like idea that like shaking cocktails always are more diluted is really interesting to me because it really depends on the ice you're using and like for how long you're
yeah exactly
you're shaking. Mm-hmm. Like there's so many people who think that like I shook this ice versus this ice and shook it for this long and I did this and I poured it, and it's like what was the proof? What was this? What's the viscosity of it? Mm-hmm. You know, and right. So.
That was an interesting part of it, is because I shouldn't say convinced, but I was thinking that A was indeed stirred because it seemed boozier
so
to me.
So many people thought A was stirred.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and one of the questions that you all asked was, what's your favorite? And so I'm just going to kind of go, I liked them both, but I'm just going to default boozier. So I chose A, and yeah, there you go.
I remember, I think I chose B, but I don't remember.
Did you? Mm-hmm. Okay. What about, did you taste these, Johnny?
He was too busy spinning.
You were too busy spinning? Yeah.
Stuck in the cage the whole time.
There was a lot of interesting cocktails. It's always interesting when in things like that for people to do, when they have to do small scale cocktails and they have to do them for a lot of people, and you know they're going to be sitting out. It's always interesting to see what people do. Mm-hmm. The most interesting thing that I always find though is that no one generally, which I like that Steve did, talks about texture and viscosity.
That's
and
a huge
weight
thing.
Of drink.
Absolutely.
Because it's something that we focus on so much in beverage generally, but somehow when we have to do large format things, we kind of throw that thing as the thing that's able to be thrown out and we don't need to do anymore.
Yep. So, a giant bucket shake.
Yeah, it's just like, it's kind of like, we can just throw that part of the cocktail out, you know. And so it was funny to kind of like see that he focused on that. But also some other people did some great interesting stuff. Basil.
That was in the strawberry drink.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, presentation is everything, right? Like mm-hmm. their presentation fully, I was just like, you guys have set people up to like your drink. Like your drink literally has to be horrible for people to like not like it. And it wasn't. It was good.
Great, yeah. Yeah. It looked great. It tasted great.
So I was like, so they did a great job. You
I'm
know.
Just looking at my lemon drop like, ugh.
Yeah. Well, you didn't have the little fancy red and white checkered jar top.
You know, and I'm a garnish guy too, so I don't know. Like I think it would have ruined the integrity of the experiment.
I blame Jeff. Your partner.
I always blame Jeff. He's not here right now. It works.
Well, fair.
And so, Johnny, did you taste any of the drinks? Did you get a chance to go around, or were you just spinning the whole time?
I had a chance to taste. Who was on the left?
I brought you drinks, so I know that that's.
Yeah,
that was it. Was that Conrad's drink with
I brought
the
Conrad's drink,
the solar fan?
Yeah,
Conrad's drink, and you tried Ashley Danella's drink.
Oh yeah, Ashley Danella's was good. I don't think I liked. Conrad's drink.
Oh, really awesome. Shots fired. Yeah. He was the winner of the night, too. He ended up winning the
presentation was really cool, right? Because, I mean, you know, they had done the charged solar cell thing, and they were using that to mix the drink, so that part was really cool. But we'll throw that beverage right under the bus.
It's a subjective thing. It's fine if I don't like it.
Yes, no, absolutely. It's what you like.
I think that that's, like, an interesting thing to talk about with cocktails, right? Like, how often are these their bars? Like, maybe not in New Orleans, but in other places. That bars are built off of cocktails that are just cool. Mm. Like, I never hear people talk about if they like them or not. They're just cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool?
I mean,
you mean like in a hip kind of way?
No,
is that what you're saying?
Cool,
or cool like?
Like in a hip kind of way, but also just like in the idea that like they push the boundary of what you thought was possible behind a bar.
Yeah. Right.
And there's a lot of bars like that in Chicago and other places. And some people are cool in the sense of like they have an extensive list of like specialty spirits. And some people are cool in the sense of like, we've got all these ice, and some people are cool, and we got all these different shakes. But like, you know, you go and you hear customers talking, they're like, I was at this bar and they did this. But never, rarely do you hear them talk about, but did you like the drink?
Yeah.
I like the adjective.
You like the performance, and like, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, performance is a part of bartending. I wish so many of the new bartenders coming up understood. They like, you are in performance artistry. Like, your job, that is what your job is.
You said visual presentation, the aesthetic is really, really important.
It is.
Now, when we get into the molecular deconstruction of drinks, that might go a little too far for me, y'all. But, you know, and I don't need
science fair.
Yeah, I don't need like 5 bits of gel.
But you know what? Those places can be really cool.
It's an interesting concept. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's really interesting. Their drinks are really interesting and they're good, I might add.
Well, see, and that's the key part.
I don't know how they are now, though. Like, I don't know what the state of the aviary is. I'm sure they're doing just fine.
I mean, they're fine. I was there 6 months ago and I still love the drinks. But, like, what I love about them is that, like, their drinks are still taking on classics. They're just pushing the edge of how they made those classics. Mm-hmm. They're giving you something that's familiar to your palate. Like, people forget something. And something that chefs and sommeliers are pushed to talk about is the familiarity of the palate.
Mm-hmm. Right? Absolutely. It's memory.
And how you build dishes is based off of, like, you can push the edge, but you want people to have something that
you have to have something to hold on to.
And
absolutely.
Tie to, right? And tether to. And I think when we make cocktails, sometimes we're just like, and it's weird. like it.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's interesting.
You guys, real quick, we do a radio show. Even though we're just sitting around here shooting the breeze, we got to take care of a little business here. We're going to take a little break on the Nola Drink Show. And come on back. We're chatting with Ashton, Steve, and Johnny.
That's the end.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Baggio heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Go down by the cow with it. Give it to him. Holly golly. Jump. Give it to him. Give it to him.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Nola Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Little Rebirth Brass Band is what I'm trying to say. It's hour number two of the Nola Drink Show, so I start to mix up consonants and vowels, and these things happen with Kermit Ruffins there. I got a woman. So there you go. We're chatting with Steve Yamada from 12 Mile Limit, Johnny Sanders from Bar Tonique, and Ashton Berry of the Lobby Bar. We got that straight, the Lobby Bar from Ace Hotel. And we're talking a little bit, just when we went into the break, we're talking about cocktails and presentation. And I think it's an interesting thing. We're talking about memory. One of the things that I'm a big fan of, and when I do wine education, I talk quite a bit about this, is that when you push things too far away from somebody's comfort zone of what they're familiar with, you lose people. So I think if you're a $12 Chardonnay drinker and that's your thing, I'm not going to be able to upsell you on an $80 Pinot Noir. That's just not going to work.
I don't know if I agree with that, but okay.
Well, yeah, actually it is. I have a lot of experience. It is quite true in that regard, is that if somebody isn't, look, Ashton, I know I'm oversimplifying greatly, and I was actually going to come to you with this question because you have a wine background, as do I, but, If you're going to always just come in and say, I want the $12, and I'm talking about retail bottle price, okay? I'm not talking about the glass of wine. So let me be clear about that. I'm saying if like you go out to the store and you buy a $12 bottle of Chardonnay, California oak Chardonnay, malolactic fermentation, so on and so forth, and then I say, let me suggest to you this $80 bottle of red Burgundy.
Well, yeah, and especially if that's the way that you're selling it.
Right. And this is my point, is that I'm a firm proponent of the idea of one degree of separation from your familiarity. That could be price point, that could be flavor profile, really any of these things. You need to think about that way. And I think the same thing like you're talking about with cocktails, we're talking about some of these things that people do weird things, as y'all are saying. But to you, Ashton, then, I mean, I think that when you push two people, I mean, I don't know how your feeling is about this, but I just feel when you push two people far out of their comfort zone of what they know and what they're familiar with, you're going to lose people.
That's a hard thing. In my job now, I don't get to do that as often. At my old job, I was very much intrigued by pushing people to that edge.
Which is a cool thing. It's an educational opportunity, right?
Well, I worked at the last two places that I worked were places where people didn't understand, right? I worked at Urban Bitter in Seattle, which was an Amaro and liqueur bar, where we used basically like vodka, gins, and like foundational liquors as like modifiers.
Cool.
To those things. right? So
now let me ask you this question. Do the people that would come in then, are they, do they know kind of what they're getting into? Not at all.
Like there's there's some people who definitely did once we had been open for a minute, and I started like after they had been open for 3 months. But there was definitely a lot of people who like were like, "What's an amaro?" Right? You know, you would make them just like a simple drink like a caipirinha and be like, "Wait, what? What's cassasha?" You know?
Yeah.
So like there's definitely like, I think it's about your approach, right?
Absolutely.
When you approach something as if it's something somebody isn't familiar and doesn't know, of course. So I used to be in sales, actually, before I actually came into this world. I did fundraising. And I actually ran a boutique on Michigan Avenue in Chicago. And, you know, you never sell somebody their first 200 pair of jeans by telling them that they're $200. And telling them that they're right, like that's exactly. not how you sell those. And there's this saying that they used to, that old boss of mine say, and it's called the warm cookie sale. And she said, "How good would Girl Scout, like how many Girl Scouts would sell cookies if they went up to you and were like, 'Hey, want a cookie?'" Probably not really. Probably well, not, right?
Right.
Like their cachet is that they're cute little girls, and you don't want to be mean.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like you're
give me ten boxes of things.
You don't want to be the person who's like, "You were not nice to that little girl," and all she was trying to do is sell you a $7 box of cookies. You could have bought the cookies.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, and Johnny, let me ask you this question, because I think it was a conversation that you and I have had over in Taunique, and it was actually at, believe it or not, in Taunique today. Go figure. That's a real stretch. And Ashley was there, and we were talking about people coming in and wanting to get certain products. And you guys don't have cranberry juice at Bar Taunique. You guys don't have certain brands that people are going to come in and order in a vodka soda. How do you handle that? I mean, what's your take on that situation?
You usually just try not to end with no.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's all that it really takes. Because once they're in the bar, you know, you can sort of persuade someone to get Czech Lager instead of a Budweiser.
It's also a sexy way to tell people they're not getting what they want.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And
absolutely.
It doesn't have to be like, "We ain't got that."
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's true.
I'm going to try that next time. But "We ain't got that."
Yeah.
No.
And I mean, and I have heard that in Taunique before from some other people. "We don't sell cranberry juice in here." Pause. All right. There is an opportunity there to say, but let me turn you on to this, right?
There can be a very frustrating series, though, where it's the Coors Light, the cranberry juice, and then something else. And then you can just offer them a menu at that point because.
Right. These are educational moments, though, right? You have an opportunity to share something new with people.
Yeah.
And
I think my thing with it too, and I think it's great. I think that's one of the things that really attracts a lot of us to modern bartending, to the service industry as well, is, you know, being a guide for people. Part of being a good hospitality professional is guiding people and creating an experience for people. I think one of the pitfalls that we've run into in bartending, though, is when we become too pedantic about things. When we just start, when the education comes to the point of arrogance, I guess, when like, you know,
lording knowledge, only things that I can know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not every single bar has to be like, you know, "Oh, we don't carry," I mean, I'll name brands, I don't care. "Tito's, we don't carry Tito's because this, but you should try this brand that we really like better." It's like,
Steve, I'm going to ask you to hold a thought. Okay. Because we're going to come back to that. We got to take care of a little bit more business here, because that's what we have to do. There are times we can go on, times we can't. This is one of those times we can't. Friends, coming back to the NOLA Drink Show. Short break.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. It's football and festival season, and there's no better way to enjoy Sazerac Rye than in a pothole cocktail. Just fill up a glass with ice and your favorite root beer, and add 2 ounces of Sazerac Rye for a truly tasty toddy. Named after the city's most iconic of inconveniences, the pothole is proof that New Orleans never takes itself too seriously. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
This is Christopher Icaza, General Manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucouleurs. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's Grand Dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon Dining Room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley.
California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers!
The French Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m. On Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the Small Plates and Charcuterie Kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Get in the groove and let the good times roll. All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today, friends. Happy to be here chatting with my friends Ashton Berry from the Ace Hotel, Steve Yamada from 12 Mile Limit, and Johnny Sanders from Bar Tonic. Thanks all for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us on.
Always fun, always fun. It's always fun, too, to have a different collection of people, because all of you have been on with me before, at least briefly. And Ashton, you were on briefly at Bakery Bar. And Johnny, you've been on before. Steve, you've been on before. And it's nice to just sort of get a different group of people together in a different combination.
I'm missing the eggs right now, though, like some eggs and a beer mosa or something like that at the Bakery Bar. But
yeah,
that would really improve the studio, I think. Yeah, beer mosas and eggs.
And the Ruffignac with maybe a little bit heavy on the raspberry shrub.
Frozen grasshopper.
The extra double mint grasshopper. Well, we were talking a little bit during the break, as we often do, and we were kind of segueing a little bit. We touched on this in the last segment before we went to the commercial. But we were talking about consumers and consumer vibe and understanding consumers, and I'll spare you a lot of what we're talking about during the break, but y'all brought up an interesting point that maybe missing the mark here a little bit on, Ashton, you said this about casting a wide net, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but trying to be a catch-all to everybody, is that a good way to paraphrase it?
I think it is. I think that there's like a thing, New Orleans, I think, is becoming a bigger city, if that makes sense. Maybe not necessarily.
There we go, microphone adjustment.
Ooh, my bad. Maybe not in the sense of like the city's getting bigger, but in the sense of like how many transplants are moving here. I think and how quickly they're moving here, but also moving out. Like that construction of space is really important to acknowledge. And I think what's happening is these businesses are open to just throw out a net. Who can we get, right? And I don't know if all of these businesses that are open are necessarily being like, this is who we're here for. It's great if everybody comes, but this is who we're marketing for because these are the people we made this space for.
Mm-hmm. It's a good point.
And I think as it becomes more competitive, specifically in the craft world or in the wine world or in the beer world, you know, I think that people are going to find that like that's going to become more and more important.
Yeah. And we're a saturated market here from an establishment standpoint.
Yeah.
Also.
Saturated in certain things as well. There's really very underaddressed niches for the most part.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. There's neighborhoods that are severely underserved for affordable eating. There's entire genres of food, which I'm not in that vein. I spent a lot of time in Chicago and so did Ashton as well in like larger cities. You have that benefit of, if I want to eat Filipino food today, I can eat Filipino food. If I want to have good Thai food, I can have good Thai food. I look at that as something in New Orleans. Like, I don't look at that as something where, you know, that's a detractor from the city of New Orleans. Like, we don't have good Korean food here because it's a very small Korean population
here. Right.
And I prefer that rather than somebody trying to import that in and doing a poor job of it. I think one of the issues we're hitting right now, especially, is just that we have a very homogenous restaurant scene. Like, every restaurant that's opening up at this point, like, there's two things I could rant about on this, but it's either trend chasing, which I think we've talked about before. Mm-hmm. I'll just throw it out there. The barbecue trend right now, which was the same as the pizza trend, which was the same as the taco trend a couple years ago. It's just like...
What's that, Johnny? What'd you say, Johnny?
That it's so poorly executed so far.
Yeah. And it's well, I know I've got a good idea. And one person opens up a decent spot.
Yeah.
And then we get five copycats, and sometimes in the same neighborhood.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like blocks away from each other. And you're just cutting that pie like so much. It's just, it's damaging when it comes down to it. And then the bigger problem to me, I think, is just so many places open up with such a lack of identity. Like the whole modern Southern phrase has become so important in, like, you know, the food industry right now. And I think it's succeeded in other markets. Nashville, it's doing really well. Charleston has a great food scene that's there as well. Atlanta, Birmingham's got great food. Mm-hmm. And they kind of take this idea of like this modern comfort food thing. But I think now it's a label that can be thrown onto a restaurant to say this is a modern Southern restaurant. And it doesn't really mean anything. It just, you know, there's a place that opened up that is opening up down the street from here. And like, the description was like, this is a modern Southern place with a little touch of Louisiana. It's like, I have no idea what that restaurant
is. What is that actually?
Yeah, what is that?
Well, Johnny, you grew up here. So, I mean, let me ask you this question because you grew up here. And I think one of the things that I find too, and there's a lot to unpack here, but I'll just put it pretty simply. You know, there is a bit of a tradition of hospitality in restaurants in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And I see that kind of being lost too in certain ways with some of these shticky S-C-H-T-I-C-K places.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, this is sort of hard to answer because I feel like this city has changed so much before and after Katrina that it's like, I don't know. There's an era of restaurants that sort of have like legacy and they're sort of decaying from the inside out. And then there's these new places that are probably not going to last very long. And I think that's sort of like the divide, really.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, like my favorite places are usually like hole in the walls or off the beaten path places like Fatao Bay or like Vietnamese bakeries all the way in the east. Mm-hmm. Or,
you know, one of the things...
Guerrero, like things like that. And it's weird that like that's comfort food to me when it tastes like it came from your grandmother's kitchen and it's not too like overblown. It's just welcoming and can't really overlook that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think that there has to be a certain amount of warmth to the hospitality that goes on here. I think people expect that to a degree. Yeah. You know, one of the things we talked about on the show somewhat recently was the state of independent sit-down restaurants in New Orleans. And, you know, the term was used top-ending. And the idea was that, you know, we've had a lot of restaurants in the past just handful of years go out of business, not because they sucked, but because there was too much maybe going on in a neighborhood or too much going on in a particular genre, and it's an unfortunate thing.
Yeah, the threshold as well for opening a restaurant has become so high. I think some people have been waiting for years to open up their establishments, and they get it open, and after the licensing from the city and all these other expenditures that have just that are hitting all of us, you know, at end of the day, it's like they don't have money to advertise. You know, mm-hmm. You show up on you show up on the eater heat map for like 3 months or something like that, and then you just drop off, and then you know you're just to the wasteland. You know, everybody's just at that point just kind of waiting for you to close, and that really sucks. I mean, it's really.
Go ahead, someone who's not from New Orleans, the other thing that I've noticed and hasn't lived here long is that New Orleans is very insular in the way that it communicates.
Absolutely.
People communicate in a very insular way and not in a very way that like is expansive and helps them gain people into their circle. Mm-hmm. And I think that that has a lot to do with it. Because when you talk to people, they're like, well, I talked to this person I know, and this person I know. And the only thing I'm thinking in my head is like, but did you talk to all the people you don't know?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I mean, and that's a good point. And know, I mean, like, information here is transmitted when you're sitting shoulder to shoulder at a bar.
Yeah.
And now that has things that come with that about who you might be sitting shoulder, which is a too big of a topic to talk about here, who you might be sitting shoulder to shoulder at a bar with. But that's how that works. And I think that there has been a bit of a substitute to your point, Steve, and you and I have had this conversation before on the show about not being a big fan of listicles I hate them. And for the same reason that we're talking about Eat or Nola, like you said, okay, look, I'm not trying to rip them a new one or anything like that. But the idea is that when you just, you're not going to make the list unless you're doing something quote unquote new. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a firm believer in, you know, what the hell's wrong with the idea if I like steak and you cook a good one, you do it good every time I go in there.
Yeah.
And it's a steak.
Right.
Doesn't have to be any more than that.
Right.
I think, I can't talk about New Orleans, but Gene and Giorgetti's in Chicago has been there for 75 years.
There's a reason, right?
And there's a reason. And Miller's Pub has been in Chicago 4 years, and there is a reason.
Mm-hmm. My Secret Santa worked at Miller's Pub this year. So.
Oh, my God. Miller's Pub is one of my favorite places.
Cool.
I've got a question kind of for Johnny. I've been a longtime resident of New Orleans. I'm going on about 15 years living here as well. But one of the things, and I dub it the Frenchman phenomenon, like I feel like bartenders have done a bit of a disservice because we work as sommeliers for the city. We give recommendations to people from out of town, and we kind of have just given away all the good spots, and now Frenchman Street is like, you know, kind of overrun. Do you feel like, as like somebody who grew up here as well, there's like certain places that you don't feel like you want to share to a lot of people because like you have this like I don't want it to get ruined kind of aspect?
Am I supposed to list these places right
now? You don't
have
to, but like, I mean, like
just conceptually.
Yeah. My places. I won't name them on air, but
yeah, absolutely. I think that's sort of a thing because it doesn't take much effort for things to get overblown here. It's like I think the biggest example for me with that thing being a queer person was the Country Club, and I really felt like that place transformed. It was almost like a 180 in less than 3 years.
Yeah,
once it sort of started to make lists and things, and different dramas went down. It's a completely different environment now. I don't even feel comfortable there, and it's
interesting. Well,
Johnny, from a place that was referenced as, I don't know if I can say this on air, but AIDS soup in the 80s, where it is now.
Yeah.
It's totally insane.
Well, and actually, I think where you work, Johnny, at Bar Tonique is a good example of what we're talking about here. Because I know you and I have talked about this too, where when I used to go sit in Bar Tonique a few years back, you know, 6-7 years ago, and I was sitting next to somebody who was not from here and they were visiting, it was kind of a running joke. I would say, this must be your fifth time in New Orleans. Because there was no way that you would be sitting in Bar Tonique on your first or second time coming to New Orleans.
Right.
And now I think when you find out about, because of the listicle stuff and all of these things and some write-ups in Southwest Airline magazine or whatever.
Best new bar in New York Times.
Best new bar in New York Times. It's like, all bets are off. You know, welcome to your first trip to New Orleans and welcome to Bar Tonique here on Rampart.
Listicles are like, I hate to get all like, I'll get on my stupid
and
I'll
get out.
Feel free, just don't
like,
swear.
Really, really quickly, like, listicles say something about the greater community that we live in and how we travel as Americans.
Absolutely.
And it's really, really troubling to me that we look for lists as a way to categorize a city and what a city means, and that is how we rate cities, rather than really looking to, like, how we can go and engage with communities. I find it extremely struggling. I was just on the phone call to help them plan our next family trip, which I generally don't go on. And they asked me why last time. And I basically said this with probably more F words and BS and other things. And so this year they were like, you know, we would really love you to like tell us, you know, like, what do you think? And what I learned was, and I asked my family and I asked my aunts, who were the ones who were kind of pushing back. My uncles are kind of like, if there's going to be beard, if we can smoke a cigar, you can put us anywhere as long as it's not cold. Hmm. You know, they don't care. Yeah. They're like, will there be food? Will there be beer? We'll be there. Tell us how much to pay. Yeah. And my aunts were getting a lot of pushback, and I asked them today, what's your fear? What's your fear that we go and you not have a list of a restaurant?
Mm. Yeah,
that there be nowhere we eat?
You go find something, right?
Right? Yeah. Like that there be no place for us to eat? Is that your fear? Like, what is your fear?
Yeah.
You know, that's a really good point. And I think it actually runs contrary a little bit to what we were talking about how information is exchanged in New Orleans, because lists are a way to sort of simplify, or I'll say it, dumb things down, right, to give you a script. And actually how information is transmitted effectively here, I think, in many ways, at least as we know, is shoulder to shoulder at a bar.
Mm-hmm.
And American travel is like a scavenger hunt now. It's so lame. It's like, here's my list. I'm going to take a picture of every place, share it with people to kind of brag that I did it, and then that's it. And like,
I checked it off my list.
Yeah, you don't have like this memory that you have. Like the last trip I took, I got to go out to Birmingham, and I just put my phone, I turned my phone off. Like, I think I had one post that's like, I'm having a great day, but I don't need to have to share those experiences with people. I just dove in. I was hanging out with some locals. I was having a great time, and I met new people. And that's what travel should be about, right? Like getting out of your comfort zone and doing different
things.
Well,
I like to say something about what Johnny said about the country club, which, like, you know, hurts my soul a little bit just because, like, that's happened all over the country. I think people should be aware that to queer spaces.
Yeah.
People and gentrification and other people are slowly killing those spaces, and it's important that we acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
Because safe spaces, whether you're traveling to them or they're in your city, are so important.
Right.
But I wanted to hit on what you said about how, like, the transformation, because we don't often like to talk about the transformation of spaces. And, like, I just want to know how you feel about New Orleans as a broader sense, the transformation of that, but a transformation of, like, what spaces look like when they become mainstream and when they become listicle, because I think a certain amount of respectability politics play into when something can be listed.
Absolutely. Here's what we need to do, you guys. We need to take a little break here. Let's hold that thought. We're going to come back to that. Johnny, we'll come back to you on that question. And, hey, friends, come on back.
And praise the Lord for driving me home once more. Live an open Bible.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour is 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
Well, after I'm through.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Noel Drink Show. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate it. Joined by Ashton Berry from Ace Hotel, Johnny Sanders from Bar Tonique, Steve Yamada from 12 Mile Limit. Interesting conversation. Didn't know how it was going to go. Knew it was going to be good. I just didn't know where it was going to go. And it's always really fascinating to get you all together and have this conversation. And a question we were talking about before the break, Ashton was asking or mentioning the idea of transformation of spaces. We were talking about the country club in the Marigny and or Bywater, excuse me. And, you know, has been traditionally for years was a queer space. Mm-hmm. And it's, and now you just said earlier, you said, I don't feel comfortable going there anymore. And how do you feel about that overall concept?
I feel like that's something that it can happen very easily in New Orleans because, like Ashton said, it is very insular, so the culture can be very exciting to people on first glance. And, I mean, I'll just use Bounce as an example because it's on the top of my head. If you take a community of people who are doing something that's sort of like their own world, it's this own sphere of like whatever it is, and someone provides any sort of like financial leverage to create it, make it better for one person, I feel like it could all just kind of spiral out of control. And I feel like that sort of happened with the Bounce community with artists like Big Frida. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it can sort of transfer into any sort of realm of New Orleans culture. I feel like whether it's entertainment or food or beverage or
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you, Johnny. That's yeah, y'all. I don't want to cut this off because we could go on for hours about any number of topics that we've actually touched on today. So we'll do it again. But it was something we want to mention that Steve and Ashton are involved in this Sunday. An interesting event taking place at Trejo on Tulane, mm-hmm. The Bar Institute Econo. Tell us a little bit about that. What is it?
Sure. So this is a kind of an insider baseball as far as like mixologist, bartender, community, quote unquote. I don't like using that term so much anymore for the big thing. But as a professional organization of bartenders, there's a group called Lush Life that does events throughout the country. One of their most well-known events is Camp Run Amok, which is a summer camp, a spring and summer camp at this point, for bartenders in Kentucky. And the whole idea was to bring bartenders from around the world together in Kentucky to get their hands on bourbon and to experience the bourbon-making process. And I've really got to applaud Lindsay Johnson, the founder of Lush Life, and all the people that she employs, because they're always looking for a way to try and involve themselves and try to get people more active and give people voices. So Lush Life was involved with an event called Portland Cocktail Week, and they evolved that into a concept now that's called the Bar Institute. And the whole idea of Bar Institute is to have multiple days of seminars and events for bartenders in specific cities, and to really involve the community, provide affordable education and opportunities for a lot of bartenders. We have not had a Bar Institute in New Orleans yet. Considering the state of where we are just kind of mentally as a group and as a profession at the moment, considering the election and a lot of other things that have happened, they came up with this idea called the Econo Tour, which is a version of the Bar Institute inspired by the Minutemen and their idea of being able to hold punk rock shows in like any venue on a shoestring budget. Like all you needed was a space and a time and an opportunity to perform. So they're in the process of a 7-week trip where they are stopping every couple of days in a different city to have a one-day Bar Institute. And they really gave us a lot of free rein in this event, which I'm really thankful for. All the programming that we will be providing for this event on Sunday, which is Easter Sunday, which I know is a challenge here in New Orleans, but I think we can overcome it.
Well, and do me a favor, Steve, because we got about two-ish minutes left. Tell people where they can go find the information online if they're interested, because it's seminars, mm-hmm. crawfish boil, going to do some food. It's all day.
We are actually going to be doing catfish and some other stuff for lunch. We changed that. We're flying with this as much as possible, but we're going to offer four different seminars. Ashton will be presenting a really great seminar, I think. We also have Lelia Gowlin presenting a seminar about negotiations and gender bias. Mark Shetler and Molly Bird, they're going to be who have been on the show before. We'll be talking about awareness of sexual assault as far as alcohol and in bars and spaces and how to be aware of those issues. So that will be happening from 11 o'clock till 5 o'clock at Trejo. It's $5 at the door. That includes lunch, all the seminars, and then starting at 8 o'clock, I believe, we have a pop-up that's going until midnight where all the proceeds from the drinks will be going to charity as well.
Awesome. Thank you, Steve. And you can find that on Facebook, right? Is that the best way?
Yeah, just we have a page going on. It's called New Orleans Bar Institute Econo. If you just search for that, it should come up. It's got a list of all of the classes and the schedule and how that all falls.
And friends, I will share that on the NOLA Drinks Facebook page as well. Ashton, 15 seconds. Where can they find you at the Ace Hotel? Like, where is the hotel and online?
It's on 600 Carondelet. You can find me there. I am generally in the lobby bar at Three Keys. That's the bar that I run.
Okay.
So you'll see me there generally Wednesday through Sunday.
Perfect. Thank you, Johnny. You, where do we find you?
820 North Rampart Street, Bar Tonique. I'm there on Thursday nights and Saturday nights and also Monday mornings.
Awesome. Steve?
500 South Telemachus, 12-mile limit. I'll see you soon.
Awesome. Thanks, y'all, for being here. Really appreciate it. Enjoyed it. Friends, come on back next week to the NOLA Drink Show. We're going to talk a little bit with Mark Shetler and some other folks from the U.S. Bartenders Guild about the Southern Regional meeting and some other things. Who knows? And until then, cheers, y'all.